You're listening to the Physics Ed Podcast. For hundreds of ideas, free experiments and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. And now, here's your host, Ben Newsom.
Yes, welcome again to another Physics Ed podcast. This week is a little bit different because this time we're connecting with STEMpunk, another podcast that's all about, well, funnily enough, STEM. And the person who's actually we're going to be chatting with is Tom Gordon, who's a science communicator at the School of Physics at the University of Sydney. Now, he has a lot of background and knowledge and experience when it comes to delivering, well, science to high school students and beyond. And he did a bit of his work in astronomy and astrophysics at the ANU. He's done a lot of work in science communication again at the ANU and has a master's degree in space studies in France. However, in amongst all his other stuff working with Kickstart, which is an outreach program and an in-reach program for University of Sydney, and he also hosts a STEMpunk podcast with Christy McMonagall and Shane Hanks. So this time we're going to actually be interviewing each other, which is a little bit weird for both of us, but we had a lot of fun doing it. So all the best. I hope you have a bit of fun with it too, and let's get on with it.
This is the Physics Ed Podcast.
Well, I'll ask you my question that we ask all of our guests.
Sure.
That question is, what is STEM to you?
S-T-E-M, or A and an R and a whatever else that people want to say. STEM to me is, you know, the acronym science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But frankly, I think it just boils down to problem solving. For me, it's just simply, what tools have you got or hanging around that can allow you, the learner, the person who needs to solve the problem, to, well, solve the problem. I'm less concerned about labels and more concerned about what you do, if that helps.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm. We find that a lot of people will answer with something like, it's problem solving.
Yeah.
Or something like that, which is a nice way of approaching it. I always find it interesting the people who spell it out, like you just did, and also there's a few responses that we get which are very much, you know, I don't like labels, so it's about this.
So I would be in that pot.
Yeah. You basically got all of the, you got all of them.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's got a bit of a feeling about what STEM is. And I mean, our work at Physics is to go out to all these different schools and things, and we hear lots of different feedback about what people think STEM is. Sometimes people do a lot of time in the technology side. Sometimes people do a lot of time in the engineering, like the maker stuff side. But you talk with a lot of people who have been doing this for quite a long time. It's meant to be an integration of all four things, right? But then again, the fact that the question is what is STEM almost alludes to the idea that no one really, truly, definitely 100% actually defined the thing before it broke out onto the world. And now everyone's trying to work out what to do with it.
Yeah, correct. I find that interesting as well, which is, you know, the reason we ask what is STEM, because here we are, you know, my podcast is called STEMpunk, but we don't really know what it is. And we're crowdsourcing a definition of STEM almost by asking everyone, what is it?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing that we don't know what it is, yet here we are. It's the buzzword of the moment.
Yeah. And it's actually starting to get a bit off the ball. Now, it's not so much what happens in the media occasionally. It's the, what I'm hearing, just on a subjective point of view, just what the feedback is from the teachers that we hear is they really just want a simplistic way of looking at those four disciplines that can be communicated well to people who need to communicate that literacy onto their learners, right? So if it means that they understand that there are these things called variables and you can apply these variables to the thing you just made and that you can measure the thing and maybe hook up a bit of tech in the meantime, it's sort of seems to be leaning that way, but I think everyone's got a good take on it, or a different take on it rather. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're not doing a great thing. It just means they're doing a creative idea of what STEM is.
Yeah, and perhaps that's a really good thing about a definition that we don't really know what it is there's many interpretations, therefore many directions you can go to kind of do whatever it is you do.
Yeah, true. But that makes it fun.
Speaking of, you know, whatever it is you do, I'll have a go at telling you what I do. And do you want to start off, Ben? Do you want to tell us, or, you know, introduce to my listeners what you do.
That's the thing. So the idea is that definitely we both run podcasts, so we're very much used to interviewing other people. So now we've got two interviewers trying to interview each other, which is kind of amusing. And it'll be interesting how we go. But okay, right. So for me, like, I can just answer really quickly for your question. Now, what do I do? I run a company called Physics Education, which can't spell very well, but it's FIZZICS. And it's an outreach company. So we run programs at schools, libraries, museums, zoos, aquariums, all those sorts of places to be able to teach kids how the world works. That's our job. And so we have staff in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne and Canberra, and lately in San Diego as well. And the idea is that we'll go to any audience who wants to do stuff. That's such a simple way of saying it. So we think we worked out last year, we reached about 300,000 kids a year, something like that. And it just keeps on growing and growing. So, Tom, what do you get up to?
What I do is I run an outreach program at Sydney University. And that outreach program is called Kickstart Physics. So Kickstart Physics is an outreach program for high school students, mostly year 11 and 12, where they'll come into our second year teaching lab and have a go at doing some of the experiments that are in their syllabus, so it's directly syllabus related, using our equipment and hearing from our tutors. So these demonstrators that we have to help the high school students are all second, third year honours, PhD students, explaining these concepts from the syllabus using our kit, our experiments, and using the same words as their teachers do and the textbooks and the videos they see. So it's all syllabus related. It's all connected to what they're learning, but it's hearing it again in a different way from someone who is probably only a few years older than the student. The good thing about it is that a student will come in here either because they can't do this at school or because they can, but they want to do it again at school, or because they've got the equipment but it's broken, or they've got the equipment but the teacher doesn't know how to use it, or they've got the equipment and it works but they didn't get it so they want some revision. So I see one quarter of all of the high school students that sit the physics exam in New South Wales come through this lab, and that's about 2,500 students a year.
That's fantastic considering that They're not just in Metro, right?
Mostly metro, but we do go out to regional areas. So in a couple of months, we're going out to Coffs Harbour and Dubbo. But yeah, mostly metro areas, you know, Western Sydney, Southern Sydney, Northern Beaches, that sort of stuff. Some schools from up in Gosford and stuff. This is, you know, location specific, so not the best. But yes, we see one quarter of all the students. Now, considering that New South Wales is like the fourth biggest educational provider on the planet, like it's bigger than some of the provinces or most of the provinces in, you know, America, China, India. So we see more students than some countries have physics students. To do this, you know, half day or full day program where they get like full, you know, unhinged access to experiments that they can do related to their syllabus, it's pretty sweet. Now, because I've got 2,500 of them, that's also a lot of data points. So I'm starting to survey them as well and ask about what is it about experiments that makes you do better at science? You know, what is it about seeing this thing, you know, in the flesh or manipulating a piece of equipment? What is it about that makes you understand physics better?
That's the beauty
of my
about
research
it.
As well.
Because you're in the research. I mean, you're in Sydney University, you're working at the School of Physics, and that affords you that ability to literally say, here's the cool stuff. And I can imagine the students, their eyes could potentially go wide going, oh, wow, you got that stuff. But then you get the ability to be able to create a body of work, which is then able to, well, help others then look at physics education as a whole. And that's got to be quite empowering to be able to in that position.
Yeah, it really is. Like, we do have students that walk into the building here, and they don't build buildings like this anymore. And they walk in and they just, their eyes light up and they say, whoa, it looks like physics in here. You know, and that's for a reason. We do that on purpose because we want that reaction. We want you to feel like, you know, you're in a place where physics happens.
I wonder what a survey would be like, again, what they think a physics lab looks like before they turn up.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I'm sure we have, you know, your typical stereotypical image, we'd have that too. But we also have the, yeah, this huge lab. I'm looking, my office is right next to it, and it's filled with second year students right now. I'm looking at it, and it just looks like a physics lab. There's wires everywhere, bits of equipment that look, you know, some new, some old. It's fantastic. But like you said before, and I agree with you, when I got to, when I first started doing this job, there was no, you know, there were surveys, but it was like, do you like this? And how cool is this? And would you come back? And I started to get the same answers. So I knew the answer to the question. And, you know, in physics, if you ask the same question and get the same answer, you know, you're not doing a good job anymore. You've got to change your question in order to get more information.
Yeah.
So, and I thought it was weird that we weren't using this huge data set, which is, you know, 2,500 students every year, to ask some questions to make what we're doing better. So that's, and you know, I'm at the School of Physics. I kind of felt like I needed to contribute somehow.
And that's really important.
Yeah.
And there's actually, and it doesn't just inform your own practice. I mean, this informs every single high school physics teacher who gets involved, because they could access that research, and that could inform how they prepare their students in their schools to not only access Kickstart, but also what students are, what their expectations are as they enter year 11 and then leave year 12, and what their pathways could be into that career.
Yeah, for sure. It also makes students like feel good if you start telling them, hey, look, you're here doing physics, but I'm also doing physics on you.
Nice.
At the same time. And they feel like they're being part of an experiment, which they absolutely are. Some cool things that we've seen come out of it is if you give a student a piece of equipment that is known to them, let's say it's a mobile phone, and do some physics with a mobile phone, which was one of our experiments that we've got in here, the students will start taking responsibility for what they're learning. Now, we kind of could have guessed that before, but it really comes out. When you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students saying this, it's a real, like, it makes what we do, it makes what, how do I say that? It makes what we do justified, because the students take responsibility. And if you have a student that takes responsibility for what they're doing, then they're going to start enjoying what they're doing and get engaged in it and then looking further. If you can get a student, here's the thing, if you can get a student to use their phone to get a piece of data and use that to create some sort of graph or table or something, and then look at that graph and go and change their experiment, they've just done physics. Like, that's science. They've done science. And that's what we're seeing that they're doing. They'll create their data, put it into Excel, make a graph, and then change what they've done based on their previous data. Brilliant. That's perfect. That's what we're doing.
Fantastic. And I'm just wondering about all these students coming through, and eventually they would then choose an undergraduate degree and hopefully perhaps a STEM-related one, or even better for you, a physics-related one. With some of the people that you work with, are some of them ex-alumni, like people have gone through your program as a high schooler?
So, yeah, they are. It's very hard to pinpoint what it is that got them to come here. So it's very hard to say, you know, you have enrolled in this because of this program. There are so many factors, like, you know, Dr. Carl, that's a factor, because people come to University of Sydney because of Carl. Or it's close to the train line. That's another factor, believe it or not. Or my parents went here. These factors are huge.
I respect logistics. This is pragmatic, right? They are physicists after all.
Yeah. So there are a number of them that come and work with me because they saw Kickstart. They went to Kickstart at high school and now they're back. And they get a real kick out of being the demonstrator for their school when their school comes in. Which is of course, and so do the teachers. The teachers of course love it to say, look, it's one of you. You know, they came back. So yeah, it's yeah. There's a lot of students. A few of them, actually. A few of them came through, did Kickstart, and are now at Sydney Uni. Anecdotally, yes, but that's anecdotally.
Yeah, I mean, it's still very powerful. I know the National Youth Science Forum has a very large alumni, and you can see them pop up around the place. Questacon has the same. I know yourself has been involved with Questacon at one point too. I mean, you do see that happen, and the more touch points, the better. In fact, while you were talking about that, I was reflecting on my own world whereby back when I was 6 or 7 years old, and that's the thing, it's like, you know, that haze of memory where it kind of kicks in as to whether you're not actually sure if you're remembering a memory or a dream, but I'm fairly sure that when I was living in Townsville up there, that I went to a kid's science party. I know this because we now run science parties, right? But now, looking back on this, I only got a couple of snapshots of my memory, but I know that the boffin who turned up was playing with his cold stuff that was liquid. And at the time, I got no idea than that. That's all I learned as a six-year-old, right? It's cold stuff and it's a liquid. Turns out it was liquid nitrogen, right? And I distinctly remember them cooling down a squash ball and throwing it at the wall and it's shattering. Now, by the way, heads up, guys, don't do that because you get the shards of really cold rubber that acts like basically really hard stuff, which all these people don't do that. But I know this is back in the early 80s, right? You could do whatever you want then. But they throw the squash ball at the wall. The shards go everywhere. Everyone freaks out and they all rush forward because, hey, what else are six-year-olds going to do? And I distinctly remember holding this cold shard of broken squash ball in my hand, freaking out. And I know that this actually happened. I don't think it was a dream. Like, who's going to dream that when they're six, right? So that tiny little thing, who knows if that was the beginning of a trajectory which brought me to where I am now. I always wonder about all that. You know, you can almost think about the sliding doors, those pathways where you're never quite sure what you're actually doing. But you do get led down the path and you get inspired by people all over the place. And I think every touch point in STEM matters.
So that's a nice segue into my question for you. What's your origin story for physics education? How did that start up?
I actually still wonder. All right. So we started in 2004. All right. So it actually winds back slightly further than that, as all good stories do, but I will promise this will not be long. I trained as a biologist, actually, and when you enter the big bad world of trying to find a job in biology, turns out there was not much work in that in the mid-90s. So I, like a lot of biology graduates do, I joined a bushy land regeneration team. And what that meant was chopping out lantana and privet and all those fun weeds that are right across the Sydney Basin. So I did a lot of my biology with a chainsaw. So we're doing all this work and clearing out all these weeds and things. And the public constantly harassed us. Well, they're acquisitive, but the harass is actually quite a useful work because some of them thought we were genuinely day-release prisoners or we were environmental vandals. So This public work was happening in an area where people had no idea about what the benefit would be. There was no communication about what was happening in their own world, right? And you do this for long enough and you start to realize perhaps maybe there's an issue here that rather than trying to clean up the mess that's been created by all the runoff and pollution, all the stuff that creates weed infestations in the area, why not actually help people understand about their environment, right? And so, you know, quick left turn and trajectory, become a high school science teacher because I thought, hey, I can influence a lot of kids, might be able to help out with understanding our local community and all the rest. That didn't last long. I was lucky enough to be picked up with CSIRO Science Education, which is this fantastic outreach group. It's been changed a little bit lately in the last couple of years, but for a number of years, it was highly influential in getting a lot of kids doing a lot of cool stuff right around Australia. So I was
Agreed.
Yeah, they were fantastic. They did a bloody well good job, frankly. And so I was there for a couple of years, but I came to a point where I thought, you know what? And you're probably starting to pick up the flavor here. I'm a fairly restless type of person. And for me, I thought I just need to start doing stuff myself. I just couldn't help myself. So I entered Small Business Wilderness. And funnily enough, winding back to what we just described, started doing science parties because I knew full well that no one else would actually start off with us initially. All right. So several years of doing hundreds and hundreds, literally, I know by numbers that I personally ran about 750 science parties myself, as well as building up a team to be able to produce science outreach that I felt worked for me. And so wind that forward, we've now got out of control a little bit, but it still stays true to the idea that I was always started with the idea that I want to teach people about how the world works, but I don't want to have boxes around how that might look like. And that includes funding, opportunities or lack thereof, or perceptions and realities around how a particular potential direction of a bureaucracy might be leading.
Yeah, sure. I do pick that up, that you don't want to sit still and let a question go unanswered.
Yeah, that's why I said I promised to do a really short story, not talk for too long. I do get accused at work going, okay, it's time to finish now. We need to do some work.
What's the most popular thing that you do? Like, what's the session that you do that most people go for?
Yeah. All right. So there's about 39 programs. I mean, 39 is quite precise. That's exactly what it is. And that's been driven by the Australian curriculum itself. Develop programs actually fit the curriculum. So to answer the question in a simplistic way, it's actually one of the large stage shows. I mean, 2/3 of our programs are hands-on workshops where the kids will come through, 30 kids a pop, and get to do stuff with equipment that they won't get in their school. But I must say the stage shows work really well because they're also about inspiration. So you'll have several hundred people come through the door, and it's a little bit, you know, whiz-bang pow type stuff, but it has a narrative of science literacy all through it, and the idea being that you can engage with your school. And our feedback from the schools are this works. And what happens when the kids start engaging with the school, like, to be honest, yeah, I'm a science guy, I'm going to be wanting people to do science. However, I actually don't care if they now engage further with history, art, doesn't matter, music, literature, doesn't matter to me. If the kids are now engaging with their school further, we've still done our job properly. So that's sort of part of that. And what then happens, that then flows into other programs as well.
So you do a stage show at a school where you bring the whole school in and you do your show, just like the Bell Shakespeare Company does their show.
Literally. So, I mean, we've got 16 vehicles driving around the place just all the time doing programs. Majority are workshop-based, but that school hall type setup works really well. And in fact, frankly, it actually works incredibly well from a school's budget point of view. Remember, I used to be a teacher. That now it's, you've got more kids in the hall, it just becomes a mathematical construct that it's going to cost less per child. I mean, just this is what it's going to be. That means that you can reach disadvantaged communities quite well with this really cool show that actually helps them now engage with their processes that happen in the school as well, and so on. And it works a real treat.
That's really cool. I really like that. I also used to be a teacher, so I know the situation where it's handy to get all of the school in for this one science thing, and it kind of works, you know, for the bean counters. That's really awesome.
Yeah, and just what really matters then is then going, well, that was fun and wow. In fact, we make a point of saying, and there's about two experiments in. We usually settle everyone down, and this is a narrative that always goes through. And go, here's the problem with science shows. And you get this sort of look from the kids because they're not used to someone talking to you like that, because you're meant to be all like, here's the show, right? Everything's awesome. And we just say, here's the problem with science shows. I'm going to tell you straight up, this is the problem. We're going to come here. We're going to do an experiment one, and everyone goes, wow. And then we do experiment two. Then everyone goes, wow. Then three, then four, and so on. And then you then go home at some point, and then the person who looks after you says, what did you see? And you said, I saw some science stuff. And then they'll ask you, what did you learn? And then you go,
I don't know.
And that's 100% the biggest problem with science shows is there's too much theatrics. And us from our visceral knowledge that kids learn properly when you wind back the drama a little bit and go, you know what? What is the point of the experiment? What is actually trying to show? What is it modeling? Start using the real words that happen in the real context of science. Then it starts to work, and suddenly it's no longer a show as such. You're now working with the audience to actually understand that these concepts being presented are real things, not tricks, not magic.
Yeah, sure. I when we talk about models in Kickstart as well, we do something very similar. So I've got a trampoline that's got a simulated weight on it, and then you throw some marbles around the trampoline and it orbits. You know, it's a model of an orbit, basically.
Yeah, cool. I love that experiment.
And before we do it, I'll stop everyone and say, hey, look, just, you know, this is a model. With all models, there are inaccuracies and possible misconceptions. So if you walk away thinking that you understand everything about orbital mechanics, then I've not done my job properly. you know, when I'm doing this, have a think about how this is not a good model, or have a think about how you could model this better. You know, I completely agree with that point. Yeah. It's almost like breaking the fourth wall to say, we're all having a good time, we're having fun, but let's just think about what's actually happening here.
Exactly right. Without critical analysis, you really just might as well just have some popcorn.
Do you do any presentations for non-school audiences? Like
absolutely.
Perhaps that science show for general public?
We've run programs in prisons, hospitals.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, cool. The whole thing. We do globally, we teach via video conference. Just prior to this recording, I was talking about, I'm really tired right now because this is not making stuff up. I did four programs to a school in New York from midnight to 5 a.m. this morning. And the reason why is, again, if people connect with us, we want to connect back with them. We're not going to say no if we can do it, right? So yeah. We've run programs to retirement homes. We run about 400 science parties a year. It keeps us very busy on the weekends. We've run programs on cruise ships at all sorts of places. We do a lot of representation for large companies. So, for example, with the NRMA, the National Roads and Motoring Association, we run about 200 schools a year, something like that for them. We're currently, literally today, we ran some programs for the GWS Giants on footy maths and sports and nutrition. We're running programs which are just about to be announced. So actually, Tom, you're getting this first. We're running some programs with Toyota in West Melbourne regarding STEM as well. Our headspace is, why should there be a box? You only create your box and sit in it. So don't create the box in the first place.
Yeah. My father used to tell me, why would you think outside the box? There's a lot of people who put time and money and effort into creating that box.
That's right.
So it's like, no, let's break it. Let's think outside it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's such a cliche. And I imagine there'd be some people going, sitting there in the car or walking the dog going, here we go again. Let's talk about the outside the box theory. But the thing is that I've been lucky enough to work with some highly creative individuals who don't really believe there is a box. It's a construct in your mind.
One of the things that I really enjoy thinking about, and it's clear that you do as well, is a non-traditional ways of doing science communication, or science for that matter.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of doing, you know, presentations to NRMA or in a prison or a hospital or the Giants. You know, I once wanted to start a consulting company that goes to businesses and runs, you know, science themed workshops at Luna Park, you know, whatever.
Cool.
Try something different. Just go to Luna Park and bring some business people there and start talking about risk. You know, that'd be fun.
Yeah, it is. I love the fact that you just said fun just then. I mean, because there's no point doing it unless you're not enjoying it as well. Because if you're not enjoying it, I can guarantee you your class isn't.
Yeah. There's other examples too. Like recently, last year, I went to Splendor in the Grass and we did a science presentation at Splendor in the Grass.
Yeah.
Now, that was a lot of fun. There's non-traditional ways of, you know, going to places where science isn't.
Yeah.
And doing presentations about that there. I respect that. I think that's brilliant. And without telling the future or anything, looks like you and I think similarly on some things. So I'm going to write it down and say, work with Ben on something.
Actually, you might actually catch this Splendor in the Grass. We got contacted to say, hey, would you want to come play? And when anyone uses those words with us, we'll go, yeah, we'll play. It'll be fun, right? And so basically what I'm describing is a bunch of ADHD types, right? but if it's not vibrant and if it just becomes routine, you've missed the point.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Well, if you go to Splendor, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think I'm getting voted out, though. We've only got two places in the... And I think I get to go to a lot of cool things. I want to make sure I share it around. I'm not sure if I get to go, but I'll see if I can sneak a lift.
But people like, you know, Dr. Carl, he goes to Woodford Folk Festival every year. So there's, music festivals and festivals and, you know, like you said, prisons and hospitals. These places are, you know, it's educational, I think, to go to those places. It's worthwhile to go to those places.
Yeah, I would say beyond worthwhile. I mean, because when you think about it, the biggest issue we've got in this community is that we talk to ourselves. In fact, we're doing it right now, right?
Yep, completely, 100%.
Yeah, we should be going out to where the people are as such and not bashing them down with big words or coming across high and mighty, because frankly, that's half the issue, is working at their level. One of the things I totally respect with some of our presenters, and I did this work myself, some of the things I look for are not science presenting skills. Like, that's part of it. But I also am very impressed if they've worked in a bar or if they've worked with kids at a scout club, if they can interact with people at a human level, that's critical for inspiring people's minds.
Yeah. And working with people is different for different, you know, I like the idea that communicating with people, if the people are year three students, that's very different to people who are year 12 students. So, yeah, no, I don't know what I was saying there.
Yeah, anyway, I know. I know from my end, just to fill in the gaps, it's not talking down or up to people. How about talking with them?
Yeah.
So it's simply just if you are, I mean, I was lucky enough that I'm an army kid. My family comes from the country. I've spent time living in a city. I went to a boarding school. I went to a Catholic school. I went to a public school. I've done all this stuff, done a lot of traveling all over the world, which means I can hopefully relate to people. And so I'm just always interested about their story, what they know. And I love having those chats. Like, for example, when we talk to people in retirement homes, I love their stories because, frankly, I'm not even quite sure whether I even run the program, because all I'm doing is asking questions and then people just spill out all these rich history and knowledge from their careers, and then everyone starts talking to each other and they all learn off each other, and I'm just sort of there as a facilitator, and that's fantastic.
I really like that. I like that. I read it. You reminded me of something. I read a book. If you haven't read it, go and read it. It's called Physics on the Fringe. It's by Margaret Wertheim.
Okay.
She was an ex-Sydney Morning Herald journalist, the science journalist, and then she went overseas and now freelance writes. But she wrote a book called Physics on the Fringe, where she, because she was a journalist and a science journalist, she'd get all these calls and faxes and emails and, you know, whatever, from mostly retired men about their new version of physics, or, you know, Einstein is wrong and I'm right. And normally would say, oh, these people are crazy and crackpots and all that sort of stuff. But she started to listen to them, actually went and hung out with a few of them, and figured out that they're fascinating people, insanely intelligent, but just a bit wrong on a couple of things. But if you go to their conferences, and they have conferences, it's indistinguishable whether they're right or we're right. So she went to one of these fringe conferences, and they all know this. They all know that they get looked down on. On the other hand, they all think they're right. So there's a rule now in these conferences where it says you're not allowed to say that I'm right and everyone else is wrong, because that makes us look like we're crackpots. On the other hand, you go to a physics string theory conference, and what do they say? I'm right and you're all wrong.
Well, actually,
it's fascinating.
I agree. In fact, I'm pretty sure Niels Bohr has a quote, and you watch me get this wrong, right? But pretty much it's like, the problem is that your theory is crazy, but the question is it crazy enough to be true?
You
know? So it's...
That's really cool.
It's very, very important to know this. And I actually totally agree with what you're just saying. I think people get worried about the minutia. Okay, here you got 99% right, but you got this 1% wrong. And because you got this 1% wrong, all I'm going to do is focus on this, because that somehow builds my ego and my reputation and whatever else is going on. Now, let's be honest, 1% wrong is still 1% wrong, but it's 99% right. Now, think about it from a learner's point of view. If all you get told is that you're wrong all the time, how many times are you going to keep putting out your ideas? You're not. In fact, so Ken Robinson talked about creativity being killed in schools. Now, I'm not going to go down that path, because I think there are some highly creative educators who make sure the creativity is out there. And I know that people listening to this podcast will know exactly who I'm talking about with Sir Ken Robinson. Go check out his TED Talk. But whether you agree with or not with whether this creativity can be killed, I would suggest that potentially part of it is that we need to be focusing on just as much of what they're doing well as what they're not doing well.
For sure. Wow, that's all very good. What's here we go. I've got another question for you. Another thing we do in STEMpunk is I'll get our previous guest to ask a question for our future guest.
Oh, cool.
These people don't know each other, right? So I've got a question from our past guest. Her name is Chloe Warren, and she is a freelance science writer. We interviewed her late last year. So her question for you, even though she doesn't know you,
I love this idea,
that we were talking, is what is the best mistake you've ever made?
Love it. Hi, Chloe. Love the question. That's awesome.
Yeah.
What is the best mistake I've ever made. Wow, I love it. I really like, and actually we are going to concentrate a lot of that with some of our podcasts about failure. I really dig failure because it's in there that you'll tend to learn a lot more. Yep. All right. Wow. And this is the, you know, the stumbling, rambling chat while the person gathers their thoughts. That's what's occurring right now.
I can put some hold music on if you like.
Well, I prefer elevator music, please. That would be fantastic.
Elevator music. All right. I'll do that. I'll edit it in.
All right, so there's no way I'm going to be able to say the most spectacular failure off the top of my head, but I must say we do fail a lot. So I'm just trying to think of, I don't know even why this is even coming up. Okay, stupid failure. It's got nothing to do with science whatsoever, but it just popped into my memory, and I don't want you to have to be waiting around while I come up with something. I do remember I used to have to work in the Novotel to serve like drinks and bits and pieces to wedding reception stuff. And I was carrying like about 20 champagne flutes. And this is, you see what I mean? This is going nowhere with STEM. But it still was a spectacular failure. And what I learned that evening was when you're serving the drink around, especially around the bride's table, be sure to be aware of where your tray is, where your champagne flutes are. Keep them away from people who may want to stand up. Because when they do stand up, they're very good from a pivot point. There we go. We can go with a little leverage. As a pivot point, it kind of tipped over. And I did get the groom a little wet. Not little. Now, that's a simple, spectacular failure. But you know what? From an educational context, I can think of some of these things later. But I tell you what that does. It does make you realize there is a thing called humility and also the way to be able to deal with a bad situation well.
Yeah, so, cool.
I don't know if I helped you out there, Chloe. I'm going to have a little bit think a bit further, like what have I done in classes, because I have had some complete mess-ups. But there's this.
I'll probe you a little bit more. Has there been an experiment at a birthday party that's gone horribly wrong? Or not horribly, but just didn't work?
Yeah, you know what? I'm actually thinking of an issue what did actually occur. And this was just not being observant or realizing the implications of what we were doing. Just a simple cornflour slime experiment. There's no issue in that beyond the slipping hazard, and you got to do a bit of cleaning up, right? The issue was not the cornflour. The issue was that we were doing it with food coloring, which happens to be we're about 10 meters away. The lady who had booked us, and thank you very much for having so long, by the way, she had this really nice porous sandstone blocks as part of a garden. And just not realizing, I just said, hey, kid, just put your slime over there. We're going to move on with the party, wash your hands, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't notice that one of the kids' cups had a ring of undiluted food coloring. Now, the geologists out there know full well exactly what's going to happen next, that it's going to go into the porous sandstone. Yes, I had to sort that out. But that was just by definition, a negligent thing to do, right? But it's one of those things that in the moment you can miss it. So, you know, when you do your safe work method statements and risk assessments and blah, 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 and you got to do it, right? But sometimes it's almost like trying to hold the tail of the dragon. It's like, what is going to go potentially wrong? Thankfully, very few things have gone wrong because the people that we have on board and whatnot are, you know, well-experienced science communicators and science teachers, and they can think this through and there's training, all the rest. However, every year we'll have something silly happen. And that was a good example of a silly thing.
Can I tell you one of my best mistakes that I've ever made?
Sure.
It's a story that I bring out often because it's one of the best. This was when I was working at Questacon. We went out to an Indigenous community in near Owen Pelly, which is, you know, Northern Territory. Start at Northern Territory, find the middle, and you're in the right place. Not quite the middle, but you know what I mean. Anyway, so we bought our science experiments in the back of a four-wheel drive, and we turn up at this community with probably about eight people in it. And we started to do a presentation that we'd normally give to, you know, year three or year four students, perhaps year six students, whatever. But it involved balloons and Newton's laws of motion. So we had this one long balloon. I'm sure you can imagine it's the rocket balloon. And you point it one way and you say the air's going to come out one way. Which way is the balloon going to go?
Fair enough.
And everyone knows the answer. You know, you point it to the left, the air's going to go out to the right, the balloon goes out to the left. Simple. Anyway, so with very little language and a translator, we were like, okay, where's the balloon going to go? And all the kids, pointed up and to the right. We were pointing this thing to the left. And we're like, okay, you didn't get that. Let's explain it again. So we explained it again a bit more slowly and then said, right, where's the balloon going to go? The air's going to go out to the right. The balloon's going to go to the left. Which way is the balloon going to go? And they all pointed up and to the right again. And we're like, oh, man, they just didn't get it. We're going to have to show them. So what do? We let the balloon go, and the balloon went straight up and to the right. The wind took it. And yeah. I thought, okay, I'm in their classroom now.
Yeah. Good call.
It was, we just did not realize. We were outside. We didn't know. There was a slight breeze that we just didn't even notice. And as soon as we let the balloons go, they just went up and to the right. And these kids laughed themselves silly because they're like, yeah, we taught you a lesson. We left with our tail between our legs and just thought, yep, we absolutely failed that. But man, that was a good lesson.
It was perfect because that's the thing. Like, you could have people in front of you. You're not, you might assume they know something, and often they know a lot more than they think. It's a bit like when we run a dinosaur program. I always say to the 4-year-old kid at the preschool, I guarantee you, you know more than I think, and more than the teachers and the parents think in this room as well. And they all start beaming, and I'm dead set serious. These kids, like, you go, here's a dinosaur. What's it look like? And the kid will say, it's Pachycephalosaurus. Like, yes, it is. I'm still waiting for a kid to say Australovenator, like, you know, the Australian, banjo, Wintonensis, but I'm still, the thing is that you cannot discount your group. Mind you, language is a barrier. We ran programs, we've done programs, we've traveled overseas with our stuff. We did some programs into China, and that means obviously a translator in a lot of these points. And some of the times you may be trying to translate something that is untranslatable. So yeah. I found out at the time that the person who was helping me out, this was around the Guangdong province near Shenzhen, which is near Hong Kong. There's not really a fantastically useful word for slime, turns out. There actually isn't. He was trying to say this, and I feel sorry for the guy. Like, he's trying to get his wrap his head around it. It's the stuff that isn't quite a liquid or a solid but drips. Was sort of effectively what he was saying. I'd love to, if there's anyone listening on in who knows a far better translation for slime, please let us know in Mandarin. That'd be fantastic. I mean,
you might have to revert to non-Newtonian fluid, but then it kind of kills it.
Yeah, but the biggest problem was I was running this to 5-year-olds. So, I mean, then you got, like, it's one of these things, like, in an earlier episode, we got to speak with Joanne House, who won the Flame Challenge with the Alan Alder Center. Now, I'm going to probably mess this story up slightly. The part of the whole Flame Challenge was Mr. Alan Alder, the bloke from MASH and all these other shows beyond that, went up to his teacher when he was 11 years old and said, what is a flame? And the teacher said, just really offhandedly, a flame is a product of combustion. And Alan Alder effectively said, well, now I've got two questions. So, and that's the real heart of science communication. Don't create a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
You want them leaving asking questions, but asking questions that aren't created by your lack of ability to explain a concept.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, I like his mind. Is that, well, yeah, okay, you gave me an answer, but yeah, I've got another one now.
Yeah, well, that's right. And actually the answer was worse because it didn't actually answer what a flame was in the first place. So if anything, he was far better off not asking that person.
Yeah.
Because they could have gone to another person who would have described, you know, what truly was combustion was in simple language. Now, simple language doesn't mean you're dumbing it down. It means you're making the idea accessible. You know, don't confuse the two. Just saying combustion, I mean, I can say big fancy words to a whole bunch of primary kids, but that doesn't help them one little bit.
Unless they get it, and if you were to say it's a product of combustion, you're going to have to do pretty well to explain
that. Totally so. I mean, I remember running, we used to run programs for the New South Wales Gifted and Talented Association, and I remember running a program where there was a bunch of 10-year-olds in the room, and long story short, we're talking about cells. So red cells, blood, white cells, platelets, etc. So I just had a kid just put his hand up, go, sir, can you just say erythrocytes and be done with it? And I went, touche, let's do that. So suddenly my lesson became a year 11 biology workshop. So I guess the moral of the story is listen to your audience, let them give you the feedback, and then happy days from there.
So I asked you a question from our previous guest. I'll invite you to ask one for our next guest.
Yeah, I've got a great question. In fact, it's actually one of the interview questions that we ask when people want to work here. And it's a good question because it tells me about where their heart is and how they think. It's a nice, simple question. Ignoring funding. Imagine that someone dumped $10 million in your pocket now, but you got to do it around STEM somehow. What would you do with it?
Okay, I'm just going to write it 10 million.
If you had $10 million in your pocket right now, and the only caveat was it must be spent on some form of STEM outreach in some way, what would you do with it? Imagine you had 6 months to play around and design it and stuff around that way. What would you do with that $10 million? How would you make that spread and make an impact?
That's a great question.
That's why we use it.
Yeah. What would I do with it?
Yeah, I'm going to throw that to you now, mate. What do you reckon? $10 million bucks. I mean, that's well outside the scope of most funding, right? So now the doors are open. What would you do with it?
I would. Look, my numbers are going to be a bit out, but I reckon I would invest a lot of it. Let's say $7.5 million.
Yeah.
So that keeps going. So it's not just 10 million. It's more than that. It comes back every year. But I would invest it. So it has to be STEM. So I would invest it into something that's STEM related, yeah, like renewable energy or something like that. So it's going to keep giving me back money every year. So I don't have to worry about it running out as soon as it will. So I'd invest some of it into, renewables or some tech company. I reckon I'd try and fund some sort of startup, so some sort of tech startup based on STEM education. One comes to mind.
Not two.
I don't know, two or three.
Yeah, fair enough. Keep going.
Oh, wow. And the rest you could do some really cool, inspirational projects with. I like the idea of what CubeWriter have done, which is sending like basically satellites out to schools so that the schools can muck around with a satellite. And then the punchline is, well, that's exactly what we've just put in space. Or Planet Labs, which is trying to throw lots and lots of satellites up into space, which do remote sensing. Or there's a couple of really cool science startups. So I'd try and do something with that. I don't know.
No, good. I love question. That. I mean, I really, really love that answer. In fact, I love the idea of investing in a perpetual fund. I mean, we've had lots of different answers over the years and all of them have been valid in lots of different ways. Excuse me. Now, one of the things about a perpetual thing that invests in people being able to, it's the old analogy, you know, do you teach them to fish or do you give them a fish? So I love that idea. In fact, I was lucky to get involved with and become one of the recipients of a Churchill Fellowship, which works on exactly that principle, that in the 1960s, a whole bunch of money got thrown in to a big pot in respect and a continual trust, which was going to honour the memory of Sir Winston Churchill. And the idea was is that money would then go as travelling fellowships for people who are doing the best they can in what they do, and that knowledge would then be brought back to Australia and then shared. And that means that it's perpetual. It then effectively is an investment into infinity as long as they keep on investing correctly. And that means that your $7.5 million that you suggested is no longer $7.5 million. It's a lot bigger than that. And that's the idea. That's why I actually asked this question, because I'm very interested in 10X thinking. I like the idea of, you know how the idea that a meeting, if it's set for an hour, you'll run it to an hour, then you'll stop, even though the conversation should have stopped at 37 minutes. Or yes. If you got the funding of $100,000, people will make sure they spend all their money to $100,000, because turns out they're assessed about how that money was spent, right?
Yep.
The word spent is the key here. It was spent. It was not invested, because at the end of it all, there's no more money left. There's no more things. And sadly, and it's a real issue that happens in this particular industry, science communication, that these funded things are awesome until they're no longer funded. The issue is they're not sustainable. And that's actually one of the things that we've always measured what physics does, physics education does, is that we've never really applied for funding. Not really.
Mm.
I mean, occasionally people will ask us, hey, dudes, you really, it's time you do this one. But the reality is that if you build everything around a funding model, that's all well and good until you have a political climate change or there's actually no more money to begin with. If you make it sustainable from the start and run a model whereby it's fair and equitable and can people who can't quite access it use money from other places to be able to allow them to access it, suddenly you make real change happen and it can't be knocked over by a whim.
Yeah, sure. I think you know, both you and I find ourselves in that situation slightly different, right? So the job that I do is basically it funds itself, and the job that you do gives you the chances or the resources for you to do what you want and more, which is really awesome.
Yeah, it's a bit of fun. I mean, as long as we make payroll each week, we're okay.
Oh, look, to be honest, for people like you, and I put myself in that category as well, sometimes it isn't just about the payroll. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't get told by your colleagues, hey, Ben, it's time to go home now, mate. Come on, let's go home.
That's right.
You know, you're still at work enjoying what you do. And I think it's beautiful. It's really cool to see.
That's what I love. I mean, that's actually quite rife in this industry, which is fantastic. In education as a whole, and goes beyond that into professional areas where people are passionate for what they do. I've argued that I haven't worked for years. I just take a long time doing it.
Yeah. what is, like you've probably covered some of this, what's next for you?
Gosh. We've got to sort out the San Diego thing. So that's only just started the last couple of weeks. Seriously, we're just still sorting out a bank account. but I mean, I love a challenge. And as you can hear, I don't limit opportunities. I just see where the dice lay, and we then throw the dice again and again and again and again. So for me, it's making sure that that what we do is still doing what we purport it to do, that it communicates science effectively in a way that's accessible for the people who are in front of us, et cetera, et cetera. Secondly, that I'm also interested about reaching audiences and places that haven't been traditionally dealt with. In fact, like both of us run a podcast, right? And the reason why I run this, you've got STEMpunk, we run Physics Ed Podcast because we couldn't think of any other name. the reason why was simply I was challenged by a teacher during a teacher professional learning event, basically saying, I want to hear from people doing cool stuff. And I said, oh, no, cool. I've got some blogs here. You can read the book that I've written. You can go check out that. She goes, no, I don't want to read anything. I want to hear from them. And suddenly, out of nowhere, a podcast was born because, firstly, if I get challenged, I usually do something about it. and secondly, she had a valid point because she was stuck in traffic every afternoon. Seriously, she's a Sydney teacher. You're in Sydney, you're going to cop traffic. She wanted to listen to people who do cool stuff in her world. And so for me, I can't actually quite answer your question because I am a little reactive to my own detriment occasionally, but that means that every year it's a new and brighter things.
That's pretty cool. I mean, similar, the reason that I started a podcast was because I want to try and do science communication in as many different ways as possible. Not as a box ticking exercise, but I want to be good. Like that's why I have done science communication to primary school. I have done it to high school, informal and informal. Sorry, that sounded the same. Informal and formal. There you go.
Yeah, exam checking or non-exam checking.
Yeah, something like that. And I've also, I've written a paper. I've written for a pop science magazine. I've done a podcast. I've done radio interviews. I've done television interviews. I just want to be able to, tweeting, Facebook. I want to be able to do all of that. I want to say, because I take my job seriously as you do, right? Science communicator. I want to be able to say I can communicate science to as many different people as I can. And that's the reason I started a podcast.
And that's because
brilliant. That's one of them.
That's perfect. And that's exactly where I'd hope that anyone who is educating an audience should hopefully be leaning towards. Now, let's be honest, all of us have different amounts of resources and time and all the rest. We've got to be really clear about that. But there really is that whole journey of 1,000 miles, just take one step. You'd be amazed how far things go if you take the step. The issue that happens, I believe, doesn't mean I'm right, it's just a belief, right? My belief system is often it's around a perception of resource limitations or a perception of fear. What will happen? And over the years, I mean, I can't say I'm fearless, but I've certainly grown to learn that you can fail and fail and fail again. All you do is you fail fast and move forward.
Yeah, yeah. I'm reading a book at the moment. It's pop, this book, but it's called the Gentle Art of Not Giving a, you know,
Bleep. Yes, I love it. I want to read that book. I know exactly what you're talking about.
The Art of Not Giving a Hoot. Let's call it that.
Yes.
And that's what they say there. Like, his opening line is, "You're going to get tired of hearing this." You mess up and then move on. That's how you learn.
That's exactly right. And the thing is, I mean, if you speak with any person, especially because I've had the advantage to be able to go to retirement homes and whatnot, and I always ask for their advice because I want to learn from them too. And they go, you know what? I wish I just did what I knew.
Yeah.
It's eventually, you know that whole idea that, I mean, I wish I could remember it. I mean, I always like these sort of stories, but when you're a 15-year-old, you're always worried what everyone thinks. And the 20-year-old, you're starting to feel a little bit like, you know, you can do your own thing, but you're still a little bit not quite sure whether what you're doing is actually quite right. By the time you're 30, you think you're actually doing okay, but you're not too quite sure. You've got financial things and all the rest. By the time you start even going to 40 and 50, you realize, you know what? No one was really watching in the first place. and you were doing the best you could anyway. So it's just, you know what, as long as you don't destroy the farm that you work in, the building that you work in, the organization's credibility and everything else, as long as you're moving forwards, that's a good way to go.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So what's next for you?
So a number of things. I've got a couple of papers that I'm writing, which is exciting, which are throwing up some interesting results and questions. One of them is going to come out fairly soon, I hope. the new syllabus is next for me. So the Kickstart program that I run here, it needs to be updated fairly quickly because the new syllabus for New South Wales is coming in, which is really exciting because it just means we get to go into the lab and start tinkering, designing new experiments, new resources, and helping the teachers with these new depth studies. I'm sure you've heard lots of
things
about the depth studies.
Big thing for year 11 and 12.
Big thing for year 11 and 12, for sure. And a lot of teachers and students don't know how to approach that. So, you know, people like you and I are in a position to start helping them, which I'm pretty excited about. And like I said before, the other things like non-traditional science communication, I absolutely want to keep going to places like music festivals or agricultural days or, you know, following in your footsteps, going to places like prisons. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, just make sure you don't take the sharp things.
Liquid nitrogen, not a good idea.
No, real story actually. This is not made up. We've got a juvenile justice centers. We've been to maximum security where you've got young adult offenders between 18 and 25. We had the high school teacher, because some of these places have high school in there. And of course, there's a massive disparity in difference between the learners, because some of these kids, they might be 16, but they're still not able to read for whatever reasons happened in their family and their background. And other ones are highly intelligent, but they use their intelligence in another way. Now, mind you, don't get me wrong, the kids who couldn't read, they will be just as intelligent. But the issue is that they've got all this other stuff going on that's prevented them. Now, we went into this particular school, but we couldn't get into the school until you actually literally get buzzed in, like, you know, check everything out and security and all the rest. And the security guard at the time hadn't been quite informed that we're coming in to do this thing, which turned out was actually a liquid nitrogen show. So here we are bringing a hazardous chemical into a high security site. And I'd been ticked off by the powers that be, but the powers that be hadn't quite informed what was happening down below. So he was really intent on having us tip the dewar on its side and run it through this how many thousand dollar x-ray machine. I said, mate, you can only do this once. You know, like, it's so eventually, like, you know, I said, like, it'd be the, I'm doing the best smuggling trick you can possibly think of at this point. Like I said, I can open the dual lid up. You can look inside. It's going to be dark. It's going to be filled with really cold stuff. I can pour it a little bit out so you can see it, but you're going to freak out once you start seeing what it does. Like, It was an interesting discussion. But I mean, this is the thing, is that it gets to come down to knowing your environment and what are the logistics. Yeah. I mean, we love the pragmatism of what is the thing. In fact, when we do a lot of events, because we have, you can hear, like, we do a bucket load of events. They could be festivals and whatever. And often when you speak with the event producer, the focus seems to be more about the whiz-bang pretty lights and all the fandangled stuff, whereas we care about where do we park, where do we put the stuff, where's the PowerPoint, where's the washing up spot, because the science and all the credibility stuff on stage, we already know. We just want to know the stuff, that other stuff, and often is not considered. Mind you, I must say, there'll be some event producers that are totally doing a massively decent job. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But there are others where you go, wow, did you not consider this prior?
Yeah, yeah. We've got a lot of equipment. We need to, And one of the other things I wanted to mention about what's next, and I think, I'm trying to start doing this message more and more and more, because not only should it be next for me, or should it be something that I consider as the next thing, but I think it really should be something that everybody thinks is the next thing. And I'm going to sound like a bit of, like, I know what I'm going to sound like, right? But I think I would like to start getting the politics message across a little bit. I don't know what you think about that, but the Dr. Carl has a great way of saying it. It's better that you're standing outside the tents. No, it's better that you're standing inside the tent weeing out than standing outside the tent weeing in. So one of the ways that you can change science or culture or policies is to be a part of it. So that's one of the things that I'm going to try and do a lot more. Be a part of politics and that discussion.
And it takes a brave person to do this, because the reality is, you stick your head above the parapet, things will fly at it. And I understand that.
Oh, yes.
And that it's just part of it. And really almost toxic, venomous stuff can come at you, vitriol, which is in some ways completely unfounded and based on their own fears. And so it is a difficult thing. I know that people like Neil deGrasse Tyson will comment subtly but very effectively on particular things. And there are others around, Bill Nye does it and all the rest. There is also some research around when you're dealing with the science message as to how to deal with the issues that happen around, you know, the pseudoscience stuff, and there's plenty of pseudoscience around, that the very act of engaging in that discussion is far more important than flat refusing their ideas, because they actually back away and entrench their ideas. So it's a very difficult line. And I'm not just saying subjectively, I know there's research on this. So it's very difficult, isn't it? And you know, well done for looking at the politics side of it, because that's a genuinely interesting area, which I think as society becomes even, like, every year, every generation becomes more and more informed about how the world works. Like, it's a clear way. Otherwise, we're still in the dark ages, right? But it's still got to be championed by these people that put their head above the parapet. And good on you. That's awesome.
So that's what I'm going to try and do. It's really hard to argue with people like that too, because, like you said, vitriol, I don't know the definition of that word, but it's probably quite based on ideology, which is almost, you know, the anti, or it's the opposite of science. Like, ideology, well, it's the opposite of the scientific process. Like, I will argue a point based on evidence, but an ideology is based on a belief.
And the thing is,
so when vitriol happens at you, it's very difficult to reply back with a scientific argument. So it's challenging, but worthwhile, I think.
It is. And as long as and that's why I said discussion based on mutual respect on people's headspace around a particular concept is the beginning of a long-term engagement in a narrative that can be dealt with over time. The flat refusal, this actually goes back to what we were discussing about 20 minutes ago, around about the 1% being focused on, not the 99% you got right. I mean, there is actually, you look at all these different things, and I don't want to go down some of the areas that ends up, these discussions often end up going. There is a lot of merit to a lot of the things that you hear about stories about how things work from time and up to now and all these different ways, right? And a lot of it comes down to that particular group of people's experiences and interpretation of those experiences. I mean, obviously, in some cases, there was more scientific method than others. but their interpretation of those experiences are nonetheless, they're still valid. They just may not be rooted in logical, scientific reason that's testable, measurable, and all the rest, right? So if you've grown up in that particular belief system and that's all you've ever heard, and now you've got someone saying, nah, ain't the case, natural human response is to go, nah, this is totally wrong.
Well, you're wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. And I totally get that. And that's why I actually deliberately keep my nose out of it, because I actually respect both sides, because it's not like a protection to the company or to myself. It's actually like, you know what? I would rather not spend time in a flaming war on Twitter. I'd rather actually have a beer with someone, or not a beer if they can't have beer, but the quietly have a chat with them and find out where they're coming from, and over time get that out. Now, of course, we can't do that with with the masses, but things like the podcast and the blogs and all this other stuff builds up a body of work which hopefully over time can be accessible and used.
We hope you've been enjoying the Physics Ed podcast. We love making science make sense. Why don't you book us for a science show or workshop in your school? If you're outside of Australia, you can connect with us via a virtual excursion. See our website for more.
Well, there you go. That was Tom Gordon, who's very much a very big fan of, well, STEM. I mean, he works out of the University of Sydney at the School of Physics, so he's going to be like his science, technology, engineering, maths, without a doubt. But having clearly set up with Christy and Shane, the STEM Punk podcast, he is a big fan and is trying to spread that message far and wide. So why not go on to stempunkpodcast.blogspot.com.au and go and check out their past episodes, because there's quite a bit of a variety of informal chats with STEM professionals in lots of different ways. Anyway, we've got more episodes coming up, so I hope you can keep hanging around the Physics Ed podcast. You've been listening to me, Ben Newton of Physics Education. I'm hoping that you're making your STEM stuff awesome and engaging and all the rest it can be. But until then, I'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to another Physics Ed podcast. We're excited about science. Subscribe to us on iTunes to download the next episode as soon as it's released. And don't forget, for hundreds of ideas, free experiments, our new Be Amazing book and more, go to physicseducation.com.au. That's physics spelled F-I-Z-Z-I-C-S.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au